You're listening to The Rick Smith Show on the Progressive Voices Network.
It's time for The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Another one of those interesting days. Big news today, GE. a Ponzi scheme. And what is it about our global capitalists who seem to think that, you know, all the rewards should be heaped upon them? And, well, screw those workers. I mean, it's interesting to me. Today is one of those days where there are a couple of stories that I was focused on all day. One of them, obviously, being the GE story. If you haven't heard, the guy who broke the Enron thing, the guy who broke the Bernie Madoff Ponzi scheme, the guy who was right on Enron and WorldCom, he has come out today with a new report that says GE's in, well, big trouble, huge accounting scandals. I think the number he threw out was $38 billion. He said bigger than Enron and WorldCom combined. And you look at this, and again, it's one of these moments where we have given corporate America everything they could possibly want. We've given them more power. We've allowed monopolies to spring up. We've given them such outweighed power over our country and over our economy that I fear we're heading for much bigger problems than just the Trump collapse. But an entire global structure of the wealthy, again, crushing the rest of us. And, you know, I said after the last great recession that we're just teeing up the big one. And the big one's coming. I mean, and I hate, as someone who is near the bottom, we're all screwed by this. Except for our global capitalists. Except for the folks at the very top. And also yesterday we were treated to an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. Again, you know, the other thing that got me, you've got the GE story on one hand of, you know, corporate malfeasance and understand, you know, all the people who bought long-term healthcare plans from GE's insurance company, they're screwed. Because, you know, what they're saying of this GE report is this could cause this report and this realization that there's a lot of accounting irregularities could cause them to file bankruptcy, which means all those people who thought that in their golden age we're going to have long-term health insurance, long-term health care, that, you know, if they need to go to the nursing home or if they need something that Medicare won't pay for, that they're going to have it. Well, guess what? Once they file bankruptcy, all gone. And all of those premiums you've been paying diligently for years, wiped away. Hello, private insurance. On the other hand, you have the winners in the game, the billionaires, the very, very well-to-do. And two of them, Bernie Marcus, the former head of Home Depot, and this John Castamedidis, who ran for Congress in New York. It was just way out on the extreme right wing, economically especially, but on every other front. Just way out of the and he got crushed, but it shows you that billions, you know, might not be helpful. But they wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal that started off with, "The two of us are quite rich. We have earned more money than we could have imagined, more than our children, more than we can spend ourselves, our children, and our grandchildren." So they're coming right out saying, look, we've got more than we know what to do with. We've got more money than we ever imagined possible, more money than our kids and our grandkids are ever going to spend. Generations are still going to be reaping the benefits of what we've been able to grab. And he says, they go into, you know, these days, Getting rich off a profitable business is regarded as almost sinister. Sinister. Nobody's saying it's sinister. What people are saying is the global wealthy have never had it so good. This race to the bottom, tax cuts for the very wealthy, this race to the bottom for working people, because if you're accumulating the kind of massive wealth that generations from now, and you've admitted generations from now aren't going to be able to spend it, that means you're taking it from somebody else. You're taking it from somewhere else. And there's this view that it's my right. And, you know, we talked about this yesterday with the guy from Barstool Sports. And look, part of what that guy's doing is just trolling. Part of it is just getting, hey, look at me, getting attention. But part of it is very real. This idea that his employees are his property and that they get weekends or time off at his behest. It may be a joke. It may be a troll. But there's our employer class who believes this stuff. And they're now feeling emboldened to come out and talk about it. And this op-ed's one of those things. You know, we have more money than you know what to do with, but it's ours. And they go on to say, we believe in well-funded government. And you go, okay, well then, yeah. Because here's the thing, and this is the part that they don't get into. When the country was at its strongest, we had very high tax rates on the very wealthy. We had very high tax rates. In fact, you go back to 1953, the Eisenhower tax code, the top marginal rate for someone making, in today's dollars, $1.6 million a year, was 92%. And we use that money to build roads and bridges and infrastructure and pay for our wars and invest in education and invest in universities that had amazing research and development programs. We did all this stuff for the commons, for the good of the country. And you know what? We still had rich people. We still had people whose, you know, great-grandchildren were never going to spend all the money. And we weren't running up massive debt. What we've basically done is we've mortgaged our grandchildren's future so that these guys' grandchildren will never have to worry about anything ever again. And this is the part that gets me, because again, we've said corporate America, you know, we got to be business friendly, Rick. We got to be business friendly and give business whatever they want. And we end up with huge monopolies. We end up with huge liabilities, like this GE story. This is not going away. And also this frame that, you know, again, you know, saving the myth of the Reagan era that somehow, tax cuts for the very wealthy, low tax rates for the wealthy, they're the way forward. Because, and they make this in their op-ed, we spend our money much better than you do. You know, we don't waste on such frivolous things as, you know, paying bills for poor people. And they're very, you know, very open about this. They want to be the deciders on who gets what, on which charities are deserving and which investments are deserving. And it's one of these moments where we probably at some point need to address this, because what's happened is these guys are more powerful than our government. These people can crash our economy at a whim. That's the scary part in all this. Because if you go back to, I hope folks remember 2008, 2009, into 2010, the millions of people who lost their homes, the millions of people who lost their jobs, all of the absolute disaster that were conservative economic policies. And I come back to this GE thing. This is a massive story. GE is one of the handful of major company, blue chip companies in this country. Everybody will be affected by its downfall. Because I can guarantee you virtually every pension fund in this country has got some GE stock. And what happens when we allow these big companies to then gamble and to lie, cheat, and steal, Who knows? And you go, well, why did they do it? And you know, this guy who did this report says it's either one, they're horribly incompetent, or or the other thing. They're liars, cheats, frauds, you know, however you want to frame that. They're either, you know, just complete incompetence, or they did it on purpose. And why? Well, to enrich themselves. And I had someone, you know, ask me today as I was explaining this. They say, well, you know, that doesn't make any sense from a business perspective. It does if your goal is short term. If all you're worried about is the next quarterly report to pump up and sell off your shares of stock, it makes perfect sense that you're going to continually get into a situation where you're lying to your investors, you're lying to regulators, you're lying to the public just to keep the stock price up so that you can shell out the money to the investors and dividends. The CEOs get to exercise their stock options and everybody at the top is fat and happy while simultaneously you are destroying not just the company, but the foundation of this country and the entire market. I mean, at some point, and I said this after the collapse in 2008, do we end up like my grandparents who never wanted anything to do with Wall Street because they were all criminals? And I was talking to somebody and I said, you know, do you remember Jack Welch, the former CEO of GE? You want to talk about why they had to continually lie and continually do things to prop up the share price? During his divorce, I'm not sure what it was. I think it was 2011. During his divorce, it came out what Jack Welch's retirement package looked like. And it's just mind-blowing to me. He collected $933 million in a lump sum for his retirement. That's in addition to the defined benefit pension of $10.5 million a year he got. That's on top of lifetime health care. That's on top of a chauffeur for life, use of the corporate jet for life. They paid his dry cleaning bills for life, lifetime access to company facilities and to services comparable to the ones that he enjoyed while he was the CEO. So every perk he had while CEO for life, and those are unconditional and irrevocable. He got use of the $80,000 per month Manhattan apartment owned by the company. GE provided a company-owned luxury apartment at Trump International Hotel and Towers. Courtside seats to the Knicks and the U.S. Open, seats at Wimbledon, box seats at the Red Sox and Yankees games, country club fees to four different country clubs, including Augusta down in Georgia. Free grand tier box seats at the Manhattan Opera, Metropolitan Opera, prime tickets to the French Open and to the U.S. Open, VIP tickets to all Olympic events, security services, paid restaurant bills, flowers for every one of the houses that he owns, wine, laundry, dry cleaning, a cook, a wait staff, a housekeeper, all of the things that you could possibly imagine they were paying for. And not even just that stuff. They even paid for toilet paper, newspapers, magazines, even post stamps. And you go, gee, Rick, you know, why are they lying? Why are they cheating? Why are they doing this? Because they're thieves. And oh, did I mention Neutron Jack, which was Jack Welch's new nickname? For those who weren't alive during the 80s when Neutron Jack was slashing jobs in this country, some more than 100,000 people lost their jobs, screwed many more out of their pensions. Also, we could give him free postage stamps and everything else that you could possibly imagine. And you wonder, and this is just one company, because most of these agreements, they're all sealed. And again, I keep coming back to working people. I just don't get why it is you would go to work for somebody without a contract, without something in writing to at least give you the chance to defend yourself. Because I'll tell you what, every CEO in this country's got one. You don't find a CEO without a contract. Because when they fire them, like they did to the Home Depot guy a number of years ago, who got $210 million to be fired. Think about that. Let that sink in for a second. $210 million to get fired. The only job I ever had that I got fired from was a Wendy's. I was working as a kid. And a woman threw French fries with ketchup all over them at me and got it all over my shirt. And I threw a Frosty back at her. I was fired on the spot, and I was, there's the door, get out. They didn't reach into the cash register and say, oh, by the way, on the way out, here, have a little something for the trip. Boy, I'll tell you, we're, as a population, we the working people of this country have got to be some of the dumbest people on the planet if we continue to put up with this crap. Just amazing, amazing stuff. But there you go. My top two stories of the day. We got lots to get to today. Lots I want to talk about. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about the airline industry. Let's talk about more upstanding CEOs and thieves and criminals. After the other day's protests in Fort Worth, we're going to talk about what's going on with the airline industry. You're not going to want to miss that. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
There's nothing more American than workers standing up, and the union gives a voice to win.
On The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1965. That was the day 53 construction tradesmen were killed in a fire at the Titan II ICBM launch complex near Searcy, Arkansas. It is considered one of the worst industrial accidents at a U.S. nuclear weapons facility. The complex was one of four sites containing Titan II missiles. Each missile weighed 340,000 pounds, measuring 103 feet in length and 10 feet in diameter. President Johnson had just committed more troops to the Vietnam War. The Air Force had hoped to strengthen the silo against a possible Soviet attack. They had contracted with Peter Kiewit and Son of Colorado to bring in electricians, carpenters, millwrights, painters, and pipe fitters for a number of tasks. Crews worked to shore up the silo, improve the blast doors, adjust hydraulics, and install emergency lighting. 52 of the 55 workers on all 9 levels of the silo were almost immediately asphyxiated when it suddenly filled with smoke and heat. The Air Force determined a welder on level 2 had accidentally pierced a high-pressure hydraulic line, igniting the fire. Investigators also concluded that the silo lacked adequate ventilation, alternative exits, and independent power sources. The contractor was held responsible for numerous safety violations, contributing to unsafe work conditions. The welder was found drowned in hydraulic fluid. Two survivors suffered burns and smoke inhalation. They contested the Air Force's findings. One worker insisted no one had been welding on level 2. The other survivor stated he saw flames burst from the diesel engine just before the power went out. Both men insisted the fire started from below. By 1981, two more deadly accidents involving Titan II missiles would prompt President Reagan to order their deactivation.
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as we talked about yesterday, some 58 catering workers, CWA members, of the 11,000 workers who are right now fighting for better wages, hours, and conditions, the people who supply the meals to the airlines, these folks who work for LSG Sky Chefs, were 58 arrested. There were hundreds out in Fort Worth the other day, as we talked about. You know, $370 fine for each of the people arrested. And you go, really? This is what we're criminalizing protests. But again, we're seeing finally people speaking up to what's been going on. I look at this GE thing that we've been talking about. I look at what's going on down in Kentucky. There's got to be a point at which we say enough. And the airline industry has been one of those places that, you know, the CEO class has really just hammered on over the last couple of generations, stealing pensions, destroying working conditions. I'm here to share some thoughts on what we're seeing in our airline industry. I've asked William McGee to come talk with us. He's the author of Attention All Passengers. William, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks very much for having me on, Rick.
So, you know, I look at this unrest as we speak. You look at these chefs who are making less than 11 bucks an hour, providing meals for all of the passengers on these planes in an industry that makes billions of dollars. It just seems, again, the wealth class of this country doing wildly well. Everybody else, not so much.
Well, I think the airline industry is the perfect microcosm of all of the larger ills that you're talking about with America. That's why I wrote Attention All Passengers a couple of years ago. And in fact, the working title before we settled on Attention All Passengers, the working title while I was researching the book was A Mad Race to the Bottom, because that's what airline cost cutting has been all about over the last 25 years or so, but particularly after 9/11.
Yeah. I remember, you remember the Miracle on the Hudson?
Oh, sure, very well.
With Captain Sullenberger. I remember him going to Congress and testifying, and I'm sure you remember the testimony as well. When he started talking about what the airline industry has done to his profession, he was a hero and they put him up on a pedestal and, everybody loved him. As soon as he started talking about how the pilots were getting screwed and the working conditions were getting worse and the wages were getting worse and the pensions were being stolen, boy, we didn't hear from him for a while, did we?
No, we didn't. He was kind enough to give me an endorsement on the back of my book. But, it's funny you bring him up because that was 10 years ago. And, of course, the airline that he was flying for that day doesn't exist anymore, right? U.S. Airways. That was part of the problem with all of this is the mega mergers that we've seen in recent years. You know, we're down to just American, United, and Delta as the big major legacy hub-and-spoke airlines. And then you have Southwest in there. But, you know, it wasn't that long ago. We had Continental, Northwest, U.S. Airways, TWA, Pan Am, Eastern, on and on and on. That's a big part of all this. That consolidation has hurt consumers and it's hurt workers. And it's a trend that we continue to see, this cost cutting. And what you've been talking about with the catering workers in recent days, what struck me about this is they sort of eliminated the middleman. You know, they realized that protesting the outsourced companies that provide the catering will only get you so far. So they went directly to the airlines.
Right.
And I think it's the smart thing to do, quite frankly, because with all of this outsourcing, what people don't realize is it's not that an airline employee loses a job to an outsourced employee, because that outsourced employee is being exploited too. And in the airline industry, that's very often overseas, particularly with maintenance. That's what a big part of my book is about.
Yeah, I wanted to get into that because, you know, I remember the first time I heard that, you know, we were sending our big jumbo jets at the time, and we were sending them to Ethiopia. And I'm going, why are we sending our jets to Ethiopia to be repaired when we've got perfectly good people to do that right here? And it was like, duh, of course, you can pay pennies on the dollar and you don't have any regulatory oversight and you don't have anybody to really act as a check or a balance. It seems like, you know, the capitalist dream.
Well, it is. If you're an airline executive, then you're only concerned about the cost. But, you know, I defy anyone who isn't biased on this issue, who doesn't have a financial stake, to say that the aircraft maintenance work currently being done on U.S. carriers that is being done in El Salvador and Brazil and Mexico and China and Singapore is as good or better than the work that is done in-house by airline employees. There's two sets of rules. The FAA swears there's only one set of rules for overseeing maintenance, but in fact, the reality is there's two sets of rules, because very often when the work is done outside the United States, the people doing the work aren't even technically mechanics. They're technicians. They're not licensed. They often are not screened for security, certainly not to U.S. standards. They don't undergo background checks in terms of alcohol and drug screening, that type of thing. It's really two sets of rules. And eventually, this is not just a labor issue. Eventually, this becomes a consumer issue.
Yeah.
Because it affects all of us. It affects safety.
No, absolutely. I fear that the only time anybody pays attention to this stuff is when birds start falling out of the sky.
Well, you know, there's an expression that is used in the industry. I worked in the airline industry myself for 7 years in flight operations. I'm an FAA licensed dispatcher. And there's an expression that's used by airline employees and by FAA employees to refer to the FAA, to the Federal Aviation Administration, as the tombstone agency. And that name has come, and unfortunately, it's accurate. I don't take no pleasure in saying that. But the record shows that the FAA often only acts after there's a fatality.
Right.
And that, you know, regulations are written in blood is the expression that's used.
Well, I think a perfect example of that is what we're seeing with Boeing right now.
No question. There's no question. I mean, the more we learn about this, the more we see that, you know, both Boeing and the FAA knew more than, you know, than we first realized back in March. You know, the first aircraft crashed in October or November, and then we had the second, fatal crash in March. Remember, this is a brand new aircraft type, right? The 737 MAX. Both of those planes are brand new. Now we're hearing that, you know, there was much more that was known that wasn't conveyed properly to the airline.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I read, and I'm sure you know more about this than I do, but one of the things that I found, you know, really incredulous was the fact that the FAA and the regulators had inspected the inflatable ladder that the slide that comes out of the plane. They'd inspected the life rafts, they inspected all that stuff, but they didn't know that there was new software on the plane.
Well, you're right. And it's just, you know, it's incredulous. But, you know, I have to say to you that for those of us who have been following this industry, working in it, writing about it, advocating about it, I've been around this industry for more than 30 years now. The fact is, we were not surprised by anything that happened with the Boeing MAX. It's a sad thing to say, but it's true. The FAA, you know, has abdicated its responsibility for oversight in many cases to the airlines and to Boeing. And so that's why, you know, I wrote the white paper on maintenance outsourcing that I recently shared with you, and it was distributed by the Transport Workers Union representing mechanics at American Airlines. What we've seen is that, you know, there have been rules in place, in some cases going back all the way to 1930, tariff acts and cool country of origin labeling. I bought a bag of shrimp in the grocery store last week, and it said it's a product of India. You buy clothing, textiles, automobiles, I mean, cars, you know, there's mandatory labeling. We believe that there should be mandatory labeling for where your aircraft was serviced, that if you're booking a flight and, you know, you're booking a certain aircraft type on a certain airline, you should know that the last major maintenance was done in El Salvador or done in Brazil or done in Singapore or China. Of course, the airline industry, you know, this horrifies them to have more transparency. The fact is, you know, a great many consumers just have no idea that work on U.S. airlines, again, we're stressing, these are U.S. airlines, not foreign airlines, is now, you know, in large measure done outside the U.S.
Now, I look at this, and again, you know, I remember a couple years ago we were fighting the Norwegian flag of convenience changes that were being made for stewardesses and flight crews. And, you know, you go, this globalization is really, you know, I think after all these years, we can now look at globalization in the way that it's been rammed down our throats as simply just a race to the bottom, a destruction of not just, you know, the standard of living that we've enjoyed in this country for a while, but also the ability to have any say in anything that happens in our country, and pretty much giving these companies such outweighted power, and so much so that it, even more powerful than our government.
Well, no question. And, you know, what's really, I mean, takes a tremendous amount of chutzpah is that the CEOs of the same airlines we're talking about, American, United, and Delta, have been crying to President Trump and Congress and anyone who will listen for years that they basically want to exclude certain foreign carriers, including carriers from the Middle East, from the Gulf states, to operate in the United States because they say that that's going to impinge on U.S. jobs. At the very same time that they are laying off mechanics in the United States and sending airplanes to Brazil and overseas. It's extraordinary. I mean, it takes a certain type of personality to be able to do that.
Yeah, and there's no defense from this administration. And in fact, you know, I just saw the courts recently, and you can, I'm sure, talk about this better than I can. The courts recently basically blamed the mechanics for pointing out that there are things wrong, and claiming that by doing their job of saying, hey, we need to fix this stuff, that they were actually impeding the airline's ability to function. And guests basically ruling against them.
Well, yeah, I can't, you know, I'm not privy to the specifics of what went on there. Some of that stuff is sealed, but I can tell you that, I mean, from my perspective, if a court is going to rule that mechanics are, you know, intentionally grounding airplanes, then let's see the evidence that work wasn't necessary. The fact is, you know, if the Federal Aviation Regulations, the rules that mechanics adhere to, require work to be done, then it needs to be done. I mean, it's really an extraordinary thing when you step back and you think about it. You say, Wait, you're saying that they're grounding aircraft to fix them for legitimate maintenance reasons. How is that a slowdown? That's in the best interest of passengers and crew and everyone else. Yeah. In the best interest of all of us.
Yeah, I want to see the judge get on that plane.
Well, I mean, you raise a great point.
No, I want to see him get on that plane and take that trip.
So, you know, as I say, Rick, this is just this is a trend line that's been going on for some time, and it's only getting worse.
So what do we do about this?
Well, I firmly believe we need more education, because I can just tell you anecdotally, when I'm at a party or a wedding or something, and start talking to people, oh, what do? I wrote a book, this and that. We start talking about this. I have to tell you that a lot of times people think I'm a liar. You know, of course, I'm not lying about these issues, but they say, oh, you must be wrong. No. Latin American carriers get serviced in El Salvador and Brazil, but not U.S. carriers. No, you're wrong. You know, the fact is, people are just incredulous. They don't understand that they and their loved ones, we're talking about American aircraft, U.S. aircraft. We're saying that, you know, this work, it was done for decades, for the better part of the 20th century. It was done in-house in the United States by mechanics who were licensed by the FAA, who went through background checks for security, went through drug and alcohol screening. I worked for Pan Am for several years. You know, when major maintenance work had to be done, the airplanes are brought into JFK Airport in New York, and that's where, you know, a team of 10 licensed mechanics, you know, changed an engine or did some work. Now, it's likely that the same type of engine change is done in El Salvador or Brazil or wherever, and maybe 8 or 9 of those people doing the work are not licensed. But one person, designated by the airline and approved by the FAA, signs off on the logbook, and the FAA, I've had senior executives in the FAA look me right in the eye and say, there's no difference in those two models. I mean, just think about that a moment. 10 licensed people or 9 unlicensed people and 1 licensed person, that's the same as far as the FAA is concerned. I think that's mind-blowing to the average passenger. Yeah. And so, you know, when you say, what can we do about it, I really think education is the key, because, you know, unfortunately, we have not seen, you know, a proper response from the FAA or enough of a response from Congress. There are those in Congress that are speaking up about this, and that's great, but there just hasn't been a groundswell. And, you know, you said it before. It's a terrible thing to have to say, that it takes blood. Look, we wouldn't be talking about these problems on the Boeing 737 MAX if they had been noticed but they hadn't led to fatalities. It would not be front-page news. But, you know, it took those two fatal accidents to ground that plane. And the story with maintenance outsourcing, it's the same type of thing. You know, those who are experts in the front lines, they keep telling me, you know, they cross their fingers now.
Yeah, I mean, this goes against everything that we've been told for the last 30 years, that we don't need regulations, William. We don't need those job-killing regulations. Companies will do what's in their best interest. They don't want to get sued and spend hundreds of millions of dollars on lawsuits. They'll do the right thing. Trust them.
I have to tell you, Rick, you're setting me up, because in the prologue to Attention All Passengers, I addressed that very thing. I talked about people who, you know, who live by that credo, and maybe they're academics or maybe they're, you know, consultants or journalists, and they preach the free market. Let me tell you, you know, all you have to do is take the thing that you love the most in this world, whether it's a person or a pet or whatever it is, strap them into a pressurized tube, hurtle them across the troposphere at 35,000 feet, and then tell me that it doesn't matter to you whether or not the work was done by a licensed mechanic and whether or not the FAA had proper oversight. That's the big problem here, is the FAA is not providing the same level of oversight overseas. And the frontline FAA inspectors, many of them I've spoken to, dozens in New York, and, you know, and now the planes are in San Salvador, and they're in Brazil, and they're all over the world. They're in China. They can't get there. They can't do their job. So, you know, this isn't some sort of little, you know, esoteric mind game. Let's talk about the free market. I'll tell you something. The airline industry has a way of cutting across blue and red lines in that way. Because when you talk about airline safety, it's such a visceral thing, it's such a gut level thing, that suddenly those philosophies go out the window. And people say, no, I think I'd much rather have a good certified licensed mechanic, you know, doing this work. And no, it's not about the free market and who can do the lowest bid.
Yeah, you know, look, you know, I go across some bridges, and I often think of, you know, the I forget the guy who said it on the space shuttle, who said, you know, lowest bid got the contract.
Right. Right. Exactly.
I worry about that. But here again, yeah. I mean, you know, and kind of wrap this up. I mean, because this is the, in my view, the epitome of bad governance. This is, you know, you have the Republican mantra of, you know, government can't or shouldn't do anything. This is what you get at the end of that road when you don't believe in regulations and you don't believe in oversight and you don't have a cop on the beat.
Well, you know, there's a term that's used in the airline industry. It's not a pretty term, but it's called a smoking hole. And that's what we have seen, unfortunately, as terrible as that is to contemplate. You know, it can end in a smoking hole. Now, this is what the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, is what Ralph Nader calls a captured agency. And that is captured by lobbyists, right? And so, you know, again, I know that the Boeing MAX, you know, because Boeing has such a stellar reputation, and the airline industry itself has had, you know, a very good safety record in recent years. But you can't rest on those laurels. You can't just say, well, it's going to continue that way. When you chip away like this and you know, you put cost first. And, you know, this is a textbook captured regulatory, you know, agency, the FAA. It responds, you know, not to the best interests of us, the taxpayers, the flying public, but to the industry. And this is not me throwing mud. This is anyone that studies this industry and has looked at it in recent years. Time after time after time, the FAA has been aware of situations and has failed to act. And then suddenly there's a fatality and they act almost immediately.
And while I'm really harsh on this administration, it's not solely this administration, although I would argue they're worse than the others. But you look at the regulatory agencies across the board, be it OSHA, MSHA, the FAA, any of these, the FDA, you know, EPA, any of them, they've all been seemed to be weaponized in the way to benefit corporate America and against we the people.
Well, Rick, I have to tell you, I mean, you know, my own personal views on all of these issues have changed since I really started studying this. Since I've been studying maintenance outsourcing, it's been across four administrations, right? So that's, you know, Clinton, Bush, Obama, yeah. Trump. That's Democrat, Republican, Democrat, Republican. These are systemic problems. It doesn't matter who's in the White House in the last 20 years. It really doesn't. I mean that sincerely. This is, you know, we're talking about such levels of money. But this isn't a blue and red thing. This isn't a political thing in that way. We're talking about so much lobbying money that, you know, the industry dictates to the agency, well, you know, this is what we'd like to do. We see that with Boeing. I mean, who was signing off on that work? Designees. That's an official program from the FAA. Well, who are the designees? Well, they're paid by Boeing. And no one can say that's not a conflict of interest.
No, you're absolutely right. And then you have the other problem of the swinging door, where you've got regulators who go into industry and back and forth. And, you know, look, we've got a mine, a former coal baron as the head of the Mine Health Safe and Healthy Administration. Right. I mean, it doesn't get any worse than that.
Earlier this week, the new FAA administrator was sworn in. This has been a post that's been empty for most of this administration. He's been an acting administrator. And the new administrator was sworn in, and it's a, you know, a former airline employee, which is sort of standard for that, you know, for that post. We've seen quite a few of those.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of this is one of these horror stories that I hope does not end in people losing their lives and that we get Congress to act. So last question I've got for you, what do we do tomorrow? I mean, because what's the action out of this? I mean, it's all horrible. It's all bad. What's the action to improve it?
Well, there are several of us on the consumer side, consumer advocates, who are working with the Transport Workers Union on organizing a hearing in Washington in October, sort of a public hearing, and bringing in lawmakers, bringing in journalists, bringing in as many people as possible to put this on people's radar for those that are not aware of it. I have to tell you, I don't think I've ever discussed this at length with someone, and then they sort of shrug and say, oh, well, what's the big deal? When people hear about it, you know, I'm talking about, you know, people that are savvy and read the news and they think they're up on things. They're unaware of this. It's a big black hole.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't want it to be headline news with triple digits of fatalities in order to get on people's, you know, in people's wavelengths there.
No, and I certainly don't want to be part of that headline.
No.
So there is that. But, Bill, I appreciate the time of the book. I hope people will take a look at Attention All Passengers. We'll make sure we get links out on how people can pick that up. Well worth the read. I appreciate you taking time for us. Love to have you come back as this continues.
Absolutely, Rick. I'd be happy to. Thank you very much.
Good stuff. Appreciate it. William McGee, author of Attention All Passengers. Like it. I hope you'll take a look at it. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
keeping the chambers of commerce
as a sign of solidarity every Thursday at CWA locations. Jerry Horgan was killed standing up for the rights of workers and fighting for a better tomorrow for all workers. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
You know, I listened to William McGee talk about the airline industry. And again, you know, not surprising to me. This is, and understand, as he said there at the end, not surprising that it's not just one party over the other. It's an entire ideology. It's this business-friendly mentality that, you know, we got to do what whatever business needs. We've got to have policies that encourage business, and you know, those job. How many times have we heard the job-killing regulation argument? Very rarely do we ever hear the lack of regulations that kill people. In fact, you know, as I pointed out, the guy who's the head of MSHA was a former coal baron. Is it surprising that the number of black lung cases have gone up over the last 2 years? Is that surprising to anybody? Is it surprising that when you take the rules off of silica dust and you change the air quality rules in mines that people get sick? Is there any surprise to that? Is there any surprise that when you have someone in the White House who says, it's open season, go, that bad things happen? Any surprise? Anyone? No, of course not. So when I look at this, you know, maybe that's what it takes. And I always come back to this very pessimistic view of it just has to get really bad. Birds have to fall out of the sky. Workers have to get cheated out of wages. The horrible things have to happen. The bottom has to fall out. There has to be pain and misery and suffering and all that stuff before anything happens. I mean, is that what it's going to take? I mean, I look at this story in Kentucky, where you've got these miners who are blocking the railroad tracks. They're only sprung to action after they've been harmed. And this is the thing that gets me about this. Why are we such a reactive society? Why can't we be proactive? Why can't we say these things happen? These bad things happen. Let's make sure that they don't. Let's make sure that, I don't know, we ensure that the least of us don't get screwed over. Just amazing to me. Interesting article over at In These Times by our Kayla Blatto. She's the president of the nonprofit union, nonprofit professional employees union. And you know, she takes aim at the idea. You may remember this meme a couple of years ago. All over Twitter was, we need to, hashtag self-care. We need to, eat salad, and we need to exercise, and we need to do, stress thing, because, we're so miserable in our jobs. We need to figure out how to, put ourselves first. And, it's going to be horrible and terrible at work. We can soldier on. And her point's pretty easy, pretty simple, and it's something that I think I made back even then. Self-care is one thing, because we could all exercise a little more. We could all eat a little bit better. We could all take time for ourselves to do whatever it is you do: meditate, watch flies fly around, like the bat in my living room right now. my youngest daughter left the window open and it inflew a bat. So the fun has, front and center. We could all do those things to be happier. We could all, but it's not going to make our jobs any better. It's not going to give us a voice. It's not going to increase our wages. It's not going to make conditions better. It's not going to help with childcare, time off that we need for that. And what's interesting is you're seeing these messages, and you see these. Again, I go back to this guy from Barstool Sports who's a troll. And there are trolls like the Ben Shapiro, who's just looking for attention, who says, if you're working two jobs, that's a you problem. You shouldn't have taken the crappy low-wage job. Maybe it was the only one in your neighborhood, only one you could get where it was, but you shouldn't have taken it anyway. You should have held out for more. instead of saying what you should do is you should band together with everybody at your workplace, organize and say collectively, we want to make things better. Not in conservative world. But there's this voice out there right now, and it's playing to some. I'm not sure how many, but it's playing to some, because I've gotten a couple of emails from people going, "Well, you know, without the boss, there'd be no jobs." And you go, "Well, there wouldn't be that job, maybe, but something would replace it." This idea that without the Jack Welch's, without the Home Depot guy or the supermarket guy, without these billionaires, no one would create a job. There's this belief that we'd all just be standing on the street corner looking at each other, and that nobody would do anything, which is just ludicrous on so many levels. But it's what's being constantly thrown at us. And you know, as someone who has studied the history of labor in this country, I go back to the Lochner era. I go back to the era of liberty of contract and the messaging that came out of that era, which was, you know, we should be grateful to the boss. And, you know, if you work in horrible conditions for poverty wages, well, that's you. It was your freedom to do. It was your liberty to do. We're hearing the exact same things right now. And we have a court system that is in that mindset of that era, where any obstruction for business, any roadblock to their profit is going to be thrown out. Anything to make conditions better for you, me, the other people who actually create the wealth that our billionaire class pockets, that will be an absolute no-go. And it goes back to, you know, you go back to the Lochner era, where, you know, the Supreme Court case, Lochner versus New York, was the Bake Shop Act, was about the Bake Shop Act in New York that said you couldn't work someone in a bake shop more than 60 hours a week. And Joseph Lochner, the guy who owned the bakery, took this to the Supreme Court because he wanted to work his employees 70, 80, 100 hours a week. And it was his right. And it was their right to, if they wanted to work 100 hours a week for poverty wages, that was their right too. And he won. They overturned the Bake Shop Act and made working 100 hours a week great again. And out of that one decision, every minimum wage bill, every maximum hour law, everything a state tried to do was ruled unconstitutional under liberty of contract. Under the idea that, hey, you could have, that's a you problem. And we're seeing the same messages, which is why the Shapiro thing is important to me. I despise him. I think he's a sniveling little snot who I wish someone would shove the silver spoon up his pompous you-know-what. But it's important to hear what he said and the fact that he's emboldened in feeling that he's confident enough that it's okay to say that now. That's the part that gets me. And it's something we as a working class had better figure out, and better figure out quickly. Because it's only going to get worse as the moneyed interests continue to hammer on those notes. And there are going to be those of us who buy into it. Yeah, well, we need the boss. Without the boss, there'd be no job. And then with that mentality comes, well, poverty, desperation, austerity, all of that. I'd love to hear your thoughts. What do you think on this? You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1971. That Sunday, President Richard Nixon addressed the nation in a speech that preempted the popular television show Bonanza. His subject, the state of the economy. The speech was timed before the stock markets opened on Monday morning. The president announced a 90-day freeze to wages and prices. He took this step in an effort to curb soaring inflation. Inflation had topped 6% in 1970 and stayed above 4% the following year. The president declared, "The time has come for decisive action. Action that will break the vicious circle of spiraling prices and costs." President Nixon also announced the suspension of tying the U.S. dollar to the gold standard. The policies became known as the Nixon Shock. A cost of living council was established to oversee the plan. Initially, the public embraced the plan. At first, the plan seemed to help curb inflation. Many rank and file workers approved, but leaders from organized labor worried about how the policy would impact contract negotiations. AFL-CIO President George Meany called the plan inequitable, unjust, unfair, and unworkable. Inflation started to rise again. Nixon continued to implement similar measures for a total of nearly 1,000 days. The end result? Inflation had reached double digits by 1974. One of the impacts of these policies were that regular families had a harder time making ends meet. More women entered the workforce. During the 1970s, the dollar lost a third of its value. The Nixon shock shaped the economy of the 1970s and had a long-term negative impact on working families. In the 4 decades since the plan was implemented, 7 out of 10 workers have not been able to keep up with the cost of living. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So here's an interesting story. Evidently, we might be buying Greenland. Might be buying Greenland. The island of Greenland. Evidently, Trump has expressed interest. According to a report in today's Wall Street Journal, there's actually a conversation on how we buy Greenland. And look, it's a big island, 811,000 square miles. Only problem is it's melting, and there are those who believe it could be underwater. So are we buying an asset that could be completely underwater? Because scientists say it could, underwater because of the rapidly melting ice sheet. You have a bunch of industries there who are in trouble because they're taking a major hit because of climate change. And I know climate change isn't real, Rick. Except if you look at the most recent report by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, say that 10 times fast, which shows that July was the warmest month in the history of record keeping, going back to 1880. Yeah, 62.13 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 1.71 degrees higher than the average of the 20th century. The hottest month in history of them keeping records. Because we go, wow, it could be just one off. No, June also was the hottest month on record in history. So back-to-back hottest months in history. And then you have idiots like Denise D'Souza tweeting out pictures of it snowing somewhere, and you go, it's climate change, you idiot, which means the weather is going to get a lot freakier and things are going to get a lot weird. But hey, you can snip and you can do all that, but as the planet warms and as places like Iceland end up underwater, or places like Florida, goodbye Mar-a-Lago, what are we going to do as a country? I posed this to someone the other day. When climate change, as this continues, and Florida does end up underwater, because they're really worried about the southern half of the state being, underwater. What are you going to do? You really want those Florida refugees coming to Pennsylvania? Do you really want the man from Florida in your backyard? Do you want the insanity that has been Florida the last 30 years spreading throughout the country? I know. Build giant walls around Florida. I got it. But, you know, it's or is Florida going to be one of those S-hole countries? The S-hole state. Now, on the Greenland thing, I mean, there's some reasons why you might want to buy Greenland. If Denmark was willing to sell, and which I don't know that they are, there's a report that they can't keep up, you know, subsidizing the island. I guess they give them like $600 million a year. But who knows, might get it cheap. It's been reported that there's a lot of rare minerals. There's some energy there. You got iron ore, zinc, you know, that kind of stuff. You know, maybe even some gold and uranium. Might not be a bad buy before it's underwater. And even then, you know, I'm sure that the capitalists and the energy companies would love to do some offshore drilling on the island there. This isn't one of the worst ideas that Trump's had. I know it's weird for me to say. I don't know that it is. I think it's ironic. I wonder if we'll put a hotel on there. And then will it be in one of the lower areas so it's one of the first to sink? Don't know. But I thought it was interesting. Now, the other side of this, again, comes back to the climate change. Because last month marked the 43rd consecutive July and the 415th consecutive month with temperatures above the 20th century average. Think about that. 415 consecutive months with temperatures above the average of the 20th century. But hey, you know, it's things aren't changing. No, things aren't bad. It's not, or my favorite is, well, it's not our fault. And you go, okay, well, let's say it's not. Wouldn't it be smart to make sure that it isn't by moving our economy in a different direction? I don't know, with like, windmills maybe? You had Trump here in Pennsylvania just the other day. Mocking windmills, yet one of the most cost-effective energy sources yet. And really showed his ignorance of, you know, when the wind stops, the electricity goes off. Haven't you heard of batteries, you idiot? But again, we don't deal with intelligence. We don't deal with knowledge. We deal with reaction and the circus that we see coming out of this administration. And idiocy. I mean, but here's the sad thing. The longer this guy is in office, the longer this ideology has grip of our country, the further behind the rest of the world we become, and the harder it is for us to catch up and to do what needs to be done. Now, I don't know how much easier it is to put than that. We could be leading the global economy in all of these renewables. There's an opportunity. And look, there was an opportunity 10 years ago. We should have been doing this for years. And Obama tried. I give him credit. But it was the Republicans who, again, you know, always seem to be the ones blocking stuff. Quick break. Right back.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
What's the matter with Donald and the Trumpeteers? Why won't they stand up for American workers and business owners who make their products right here in the good old U.S. of A.? Oh yeah, I know they talk a good game. Trump himself even issued a bold, star-spangled executive order promoting the purchase of, quote, American-made goods produced by American labor. We consumers respond positively to that pitch, generally preferring to buy everything from mattresses to hockey pucks that are manufactured here at home. For example, take Patriot Puck. What's not to like about this corporation, which literally wraps its hockey pucks in American flag packaging and proudly advertises that they are, quote, the only American-made hockey puck? Well, sadly, one thing not to like is that the puck seller's pitch was a lie. Its product actually turns out to be made in China. Such a deceptive sales scam is not just unethical, it's a federal crime. Saddest of all, though, is that when honest competitors and defrauded consumers protested the firm's blatant deceit, Trump's Federal Trade Commission appointees proved to be Made in America wimps. Far from standing up for U.S. workers, they coddled the job-stealing culprit. They issued no fines, required no admission of the obvious corporate crime, didn't even make Patriot Puck notify customers of its false marketing scam, and let it keep all the profits it pocketed from the fraud. Instead, Trump's regulatory toughies insisted that the threat of future fines would keep such outlaws in check. This is Jim Hightower saying, seriously? The real crime here is that our nation's president is mocking the plight of America's manufacturing workers by making a spectacle of standing up for them, then kowtowing to corporations that flagrantly violate Made in America laws. It's a shameful political fraud.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why.